Proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Milton Friedman's birthday today. Milton Friedman, the guy who founded what is referred to broadly as the Chicago School of Economics, modern day conservative economics, many would refer to it as. Tom Friedman, in some ways, carrying the torch, taking on Milton John Maynard Keynes, or John the Keynesian economics in large part, and suggesting that things like the minimum wage are a bad idea. John Maynard Keynes. And so here we have Michael Chapman with us from the conservative Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com. He's the managing editor of CNSNews.com. And, hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're of the opinion that raising the minimum wage, which Congress just did by attaching it to this appropriations bill for Iraq, which seems like a rather tragically, you know, back around the back door way to do it, but nonetheless, that raising the minimum wage is going to be a bad thing. What evidence do you have to demonstrate that?
Well, there's a lot of statistical data and empirical evidence and studies by a number of economists who've looked at this issue. And it depends.
For example.
Well, for example, today you mentioned Milton Friedman, for example, his birthday, and in his book, for example, Free to Choose, which was a highly popular book, sold very well in America, he devotes a number of pages to the minimum wage laws that have passed over the years, and he argues that it is one of, for example, one of the most anti-black laws on the books, because when you raise the minimum wage, you tend to price out those workers who are on the lower scale in terms of skills and who are getting their first-time jobs and trying to get a leg up.
Well, that was Milton Friedman's theory, but in the years since the publication of that, we've demonstrated that that theory is nonsense. If you go through and look at every single year from the 1930s when the minimum wage was first put into place up until today, I defy you to find any two or three years in a row when the minimum wage was increased and there was a corresponding increase in either inflation or unemployment. It never happened. In fact, in most cases, when the minimum wage went up, employment went up and GDP went up.
Well, it depends.
Proving demand side economics, not supply side economics. Proving that Milton Friedman was right and John Keynes was right was wrong, and John Keynes was right.
Well, there are other studies which one can cite as well. But when you look in the details of the studies, is they found that if the increase is a little bit, you know, no more than a 10% increase, then there is really no real measurable drop in employment. But when it gets above 10%, you can see drops in unemployment. But
there's never been more than a 10% increase in the minimum wage.
But the other factor that needs to be considered is that while there may not be substantial drops in unemployment at a 10% or lower increase, a lot of the businesses involved will cut back on some of the benefits and favorable working conditions that the workers had in those places, and it becomes a much more difficult place to work. They will expect more out of these workers than they were getting prior to the increases.
So there's non-monetary
effects involved. I'm just telling you what some of the economists have said. This is not.
Yeah, but I'm talking about what's real. I mean, you look at what happened.
Well, it is what's real, and it has been measured, and there are a number of studies, and I can email you the list of studies if you want to do that. But you know.
Well, I suppose we could do dueling studies. I mean, how do you respond to the fact? And this is a fact that states that have higher state minimum wages have higher economic growth. In fact, on average, between 1998 and 2002, a study done by the Fiscal Policy Institute, the 2004 study, found that the number of small businesses, that defined as those people with fewer than 50 employees, in those states with the highest minimum wages in the country, grew twice as fast as in those states with the lowest minimum wages.
Well, so what? There's no necessarily any correlation whatsoever. There can be a...
Well, no, there is a huge correlation,
no,
and that is that when you give people money at the...
Will you let me finish? There are a variety of factors that can contribute to economic growth. States could have the highest minimum wages, you know, around the world, if you put it that way. But you have to look at the other economic factors that are going on in those states and in those localities and those businesses and those investments, tax rates, you know, immigration, everything that's involved that can contribute to economic growth. You can't just say because, you know, the minimum wage went up in that state and the economy boomed.
Michael, what this really boils down to is the debate over what's the best way to stimulate the economy. And starting with Reagan started promoting supply-side economics, this fantasy that Milton Friedman didn't come up with and was never a full advocate of, but
right.
I would say set the foundation for. And the suggestion that if we make sure that the wealthy and the hyper-wealthy are doing very, very well, thank you very much, that money will trickle down to the lower classes, whereas classical economics, going back a long, long way, and certainly Keynesian economics posits that if you give money to people who spend 100% of their income, which is 100% of the time, the minimum wage workers, if you give more money to those people, they will spend it. And by spending it, they'll spend 100% of it. Whereas if you give more money to Bill Gates, he'll invest more of it, probably in India. And so if you give money to the people who are minimum wage workers, they're going to spend it. And by spending it, they increase demand. And by increasing demand, as a consequence of the increased demand, you have more businesses, and particularly more small businesses, coming out and saying, hey, there's more demand. I think that I'll start a business to fulfill that demand.
Right, and as far as stimulating demand to fuel economic growth, I mean, I agree with you there, and I think Ronald Reagan would agree with you there. But when you talk about the wealthy, you know, 2 or 10, 5%, whatever it is, the wealthiest class getting these tax cuts and so on, you have to keep in mind that the wealthy, for most of them, their money does not just sit in the bank; it is invested in a variety of different ways. The banks themselves, when they have more money in the banks, they loan the money. It helps with mortgages and small businesses and so on. So the money.
Michael, please tell
down.
Me, how does George W. Bush's $100 million trust fund that is invested mostly in treasuries, how is that creating jobs?
Well, I'd have to look at the details of what his trust fund says. I don't know, but you're asking me in general about stimulating or fueling demand. How can we get people to spend more, to invest more in the economy? And if people have more money, they tend to spend it, or they invest it, or they buy a home. You know, they can get a mutual fund, they can buy stocks. You know, whatever it is.
You're making an argument for an increase in the minimum wage. You're not making an argument for tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. I mean, the fact of the matter is, when Gordon Smith and a bunch of other Republican senators got together and said, "Let's have a tax holiday on over $50 billion of money that American corporations had in foreign countries, and let's reduce their tax rate down to 5%." So they can repatriate those funds. They were all claiming that 660,000 jobs were going to be created. Instead, the corporations that took those tax breaks, in particular the pharmaceutical companies, laid off over 30,000 people. Started with all the jobs that were created outside the United States, mostly in low-wage countries, and just basically had a field day with the profits.
Well, politicians will say whatever they need to say to get elected, to stay in office, to be favorable. And I'm not going to defend what some Republican politicians may have said about those tax cuts anymore.
No, but it comes down to demand-side economics versus supply-side economics.
On the minimum wage. I mean, politicians use the minimum wage, for example, as a tool. They say, how can you be against, you know, helping the people who are on the lower end of the wage scale? How can you oppose giving them a boost in their wage to help them get their feet on the ground, to maybe move up the ladder?
Michael,
my point is, here's the basic argument. If you believe that the minimum wage is a good thing and that will fuel demand, then raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour.
No, that makes no sense, because it's stupid.
That's your logic.
The question is, should a person who works a 40-hour week be able to raise a family in America?
But who are you to decide?
Should somebody who plays by the rules be able to raise a family in America?
It depends on that family and all the variables in their family.
So you say no, and I say yes. That's the bottom line. That's the specific cleavage. The whole point of the minimum wage is, it goes all the way back to the Republican Teddy Roosevelt, is that if somebody works hard and plays by the rules, they should be able to raise a family in America.
Of course.
And you guys say, no, they shouldn't. They should live in poverty.
But with the minimum wage, you're saying that a government committee can determine, with the millions of variables involved, with a population close to 300 million, that it can determine what the price is for a wage. You're saying,
yes, and they have done that successfully in the past.
To do that. No, that's what you're saying. You're saying,
I am saying that, absolutely. And I'm saying that they have done that successfully all the way up until Reagan came into office.
Well, if you think a government can set prices on wages, then they can set prices on bread, milk, a bushel of
apples. I'm not talking about prices. I'm talking about floors.
The Soviet Union. I mean, if you think it worked well, go to Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union prior to 1991.
Okay, Michael Chabon, the managing editor of CNSNews.com. Thanks, Michael, for being with us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
So here now, the Republicans have succeeded in getting a minimum wage increase passed. I mean, we'll see how the fate of this thing works out. Republicans pushing back really, really hard. It's interesting to remember that at the founding of this country, the debate was not about minimum wage laws, it was about maximum wage laws. One of the things that the founders of this country and the framers of the Constitution objected to in British law in the 1700s, was maximum wage laws. I kid you not. And this had been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years in Europe, and it was a big deal, particularly in the British economy, where they said, they did not want the rabble to become the middle class. Because if they did, they might get politically active. And if they got politically active, then look out. And in fact, that's exactly what happened in North America in 1776, is the rabble did become the middle class, and the middle class did say, okay, that's it, guys. We want some say in how we govern ourselves. But the maximum wage laws that were in place in England essentially made it impossible for working people to ever break out of poverty. And that was the goal of them. The absolute explicit goal of them was to keep people from breaking out of poverty. And now we have maximum wage laws that are far more subtle, not explicit at all. But they're things like, the threat of moving the job to China, the threat of moving the job to Mexico, these weird trade agreements. The surrender of U.S. sovereignty to the World Trade Organization, the surrender of U.S. sovereignty to the North American Free Trade Agreement, to NAFTA, and NAFTA's Chapter 11, which says that individual corporations can sue our government and force them to change their behavior. So anyhow, now we have minimum wage laws, and there's a couple of big myths about minimum wage laws out there, that they will hurt small businesses. In fact, history demonstrates that they don't, that they help small businesses, because small businesses are the first line of beneficiaries from economic stimulus, from people who are earning minimum wage, spending their money. Another, that only teenagers and part-time workers benefit from it. In fact, over a third of all the people who are working at the minimum wage are trying to raise a family. They're primary wage earners for a family. or that it's going to result in job losses or discourage job creation. Ain't true. You know, I'm broadcasting here from a state where the minimum wage is over $7.50 an hour. And Oregon is experiencing extraordinary economic growth and has been consistently. And every time the minimum wage in this state is increased, economic growth goes up. Because demand-side economics actually works. Supply-side economics is a fantasy. Supply-side economics has brought us the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and the middle class gets wiped out. But the big question that we really haven't discussed in this country since the 1930s, and frankly, it's the conversation that we need to come back to in the context of the middle wage, the minimum wage. The big question now in this country should be, should we have regulated capitalism in the United States and regulate it in such a way that, yeah, you can start a business. Yes, you can get rich. Nobody's going to stop you. In fact, it's a good thing. You know, we want people to participate in the economy. We love free enterprise in this country. And that said, when you hire people, if you're going to run a business and you can't run that business in a way that you can pay your employees a decent wage, then you have no business having a business. That's not a viable business. If the only way that your business can survive is if you have to pay people starvation wages or you have to pay people poverty wages, then that's just not a legitimate business. That's what a minimum wage law says, in essence. And it makes conservatives crazy because, you know, hey, you know, the more people who are in poverty, the more likely they are to not participate in the political process, the more likely they are not to go out in the streets and protest government policies or other conservative policies, the more likely they are not to have a union, the more likely they are not to stand up to people, particularly to the powers that be, to their employers, to big transnational corporations. And that's a desirable outcome from the conservative point of view. But this really needs to be the framing device, in my opinion, for the minimum wage. And when you put it in that context, and you ask the question, well, what is a reasonable minimum wage in the United States for somebody to try to, at the very least, live their own lives and not live in poverty and not have to make choices between dog food and medication? I mean, what is that threshold? And for a lot of states, it's in the $7 range, the mid $7 range. And frankly, I think that even that is, you know, pretty dangerously low. Very dangerously low, in fact. Coming up later on the program, by the way, Tom Hayden's going to be with us in our second hour. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270, 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
There's a dark and the troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view.
Keep on the sunny side. Always on the sunny side.
Hey, Air Americans, head over to airamerica.com on the Tom Hartman page. Click on my name or face or whatever. It'll get you over to our page where you can join our blog and toss in your 2 cents on the issues of the day. It'll also put you in the running for our giveaway today of a copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, my new book. So blog with us over at airamerica.com. 34 minutes past the hour. Just a quick heads up. Lauren Kirshner, who helps put together this program and make it run every day out of New York, is going to, and also helps produce Sam Cedar's show, is going to be at the Daily Kos convention. Lauren, right?
That's right.
And you're going to be calling into our show while you're there?
On Thursday and Friday.
Great. And filling people in. Okay, so we're very much looking forward to that. And it's interesting, the number of people I've had, you know, ask me if I'm going to be there. And I said, no, but Lauren's going to be there. Oh, well, I'll look for her. So, you know, you're going to have a couple of people saying hi to you.
I'll wear a name tag then.
There you go.
Hey, Tom, you should know that I'll also be in Chicago, but I'll be at the Cubs game.
So, oh, really?
Yes.
That's Chris Lopresto.
Yeah, sorry. Hi. And I don't know if you'll want an update from the Cubs game, but you're welcome to it.
Well, you can give us the score.
Sure.
At the end of the game. Good one. Okay, Lauren and Chris, thank you so much. Oh, amazing. The minimum wage, there's a lot of other things in the news, by the way, and then we're going to get to your calls here right now, but just a quick heads up. Mike Stark over at callingallwingnuts.com. Mike has been a guest on this program a number of times. And Mike, a little bit of payback, I guess. Bill O'Reilly sent a camera crew over to the home of the CEO of JetBlue to stake out his apartment and harass the guy as he was walking out, asking him if he agreed with some of the statements made by comments that were posted over the Daily Kos, not by the bloggers themselves, but by people posting comments. And some of them were pretty outrageous. And, of course, he was, you know, taken aback and shocked. And O'Reilly has on other occasions, for example, a telephone conversation with O'Reilly, he said, quote, if any woman ever breathed the word, I'll make her pay so dearly that she'll wish she'd never been born. I'll rake her through the mud, bring up things in her life and make her so miserable she'll be destroyed. I mean, this is Bill O'Reilly, right? And you can see it over at callingallwingnuts.com. So anyhow, they showed up at O'Reilly's house and asked him a couple of tough questions. We'll be sharing more about that with you as the week goes on. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Alex in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Alex, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I guess I'm one of those crazy conservatives, but I like your show anyway. It's good to...
Well, thank you. That's why I put you on first.
A different point of view sometimes. I don't think a federally mandated minimum wage is that great. I mean, I'm kind of against my own party on this. It's just that the cost of living from state to state can vary so much. I mean, I don't think it's right for the federal government to mandate a minimum wage that would go from coast to coast. And I mean, if we want from your-
why not? I'm not suggesting that the federal minimum wage should be what you can live on in Portland, Oregon, or Los Angeles, California. I think that those communities have an obligation to establish their own minimum wage. I mean, we've certainly done that here in Oregon. I believe you've done it in California. I may be wrong.
Yeah, we have our own minimum wage.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's so what the federal minimum wage becomes is a national absolute. You can't crash through this floor. It acts as a safety net, basically, for workers in this country. And isn't that one of the functions of government, to provide a safety net for all of us?
I can agree with you on one level, but on another level, I mean, I live in Southern California, and, I mean, we have a large pool of workers that are willing to work for less. On some level, I mean, I just believe we got to let the free market decide that. I mean,
there's no such thing as a free market. I mean, you know, you've got a market that right now is being, in Southern California in particular, is being distorted by a lot of people coming in from south of the United States and being here illegally. For example, I'd say an even larger variable is that we've got a market that's being distorted by laws that say that that corporate interests, such as patent and copyright protection, will absolutely be respected at the border. You know, we will fight to protect those. But labor's interests, the ability to work at a certain wage, that's out the door. You know, we call that free trade. So you can move cheap labor overseas all you want, but you can't move a cheap trademark or patent overseas. It ain't going to happen. So, you know, that's not a free market. That's a rigged market. It's a market that's rigged in favor of transnational corporations and against labor.
Well, that's a good argument, but I
and that's
know.
My
I
point. Mean, as a consequence of that, you got people who are willing to work for $2 an hour because they live in China or because they just came from an area where you've got incredible poverty in some other country. And what we should be doing is we should be saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, China can develop their own economy and people who are living in poverty in countries near us will do everything we can to help them develop their country and their local economy, but not at the expense of our economy.
Yeah, but I mean, we do support trade though. I mean, you sound a little like Pat Buchanan here.
Well, you know, there's at a certain level, common sense is independent of party. And if you go back and read Adam Smith, 1776, Wealth of Nations, the example that he used, as I recall, it's been 30 years since I read it, but this is my recollection, it's pretty close to this, is like you've got one country that because of their geography and their natural resources, they find it really easy to grow sheep, you know, to have a lot of very high quality wool. You've got another country where they can easily have cattle, and so they have a lot of good milk and cheese. And you got another country where they grow grapes really, really well, and so they make a lot of wine. So in each one of these three countries, you know, the country where they have the sheep, they don't have very good cheese, and they don't have any wine at all. And the country where they have wine, they don't have sheep, and they don't have cheese. And so if these three countries trade, then everybody in all three countries gets wine, cheese, and a good sweater. That's a desirable outcome. But what happens...
It assumes near full employment in all three countries, though, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely, number one. And number two, what happens when one of those three countries starts not only making wine, but also starts making cheese? At that point, or if all three countries start making cheese, at that point, then it actually becomes useful for all three countries, if they're all making cheese, to protect their local cheese markets by saying, okay, you know, we will bring in imported cheese, but it's going to be slightly more important, more expensive than our local cheese. And we're going to regulate that with import tariffs. And that's how we maintained, that's how we built and maintained the economy of the United States from the founding of this country up until Bill Clinton pulled it apart with NAFTA and WTO. Although we still have some tariffs, they average around 2% now, but they average, you know, in the 20% region all the way up until the 1980s. And in fact, tariffs were so important to the United States that they that 100% of the revenue that the federal government of the United States operated on, the salaries of the Senate, the House, all federal agencies, the President, the Army, everything, 100% of that money from the founding of this country until the Civil War came from tariffs. Two-thirds of the entire funding of the United States from the Civil War until World War I came from tariffs, and fully a third of the federal budget came from tariffs from World War I to World War II, as the government got dramatically bigger as a consequence of World War I. It has worked in the past. It creates a solid base for labor, and then you have minimum wage laws, and you allow unionization, and boom, you've got a middle class.
I don't think, the size of the government now cannot be supported on tariff revenue alone, though. I mean,
no, it's not. Tariffs are a tiny drop in the bucket now in terms of government revenue for the United States.
That's an impossible.
We would have to undo the trade agreements and go back to a tariff-based trade system. And, you know, the structure is all there because we still are charging tariffs. It's just that they're like, you know, 0.3%, 0.9%, 1.7%, like that. But we charge tariffs on, you know, 20, 30,000 different items or categories of items. But the tariffs have become negligible, whereas other countries are aggressively charging tariffs. And China, for example, you want to import a car into China, it's 20% import tariff. But if you want to import a Chinese car into the United States, it's 2% import tariff. That makes no sense. These guys say free trade. There is no free trade. There's no country in the world that's engaged in free trade. What there is there's trade that favors corporations, or there's trade that favors nations and labor. And historically in the United States, we had trade that favored individual nations and labor. In other words, the concept of nationhood and sovereignty and independence and labor within that country. And frankly, business, particularly small business as well. And what we have now had for 26 years, ever since the so-called Reagan Revolution, is increasingly trade that only favors big transnational corporations and global corporations that are in many cases larger, in fact in most cases larger than government. I mean, you've got 52 corporations that are among the 100 largest economies in the world, that are larger than all but maybe 8 or 10 governments in the world. This is not it's not a good thing for America, frankly. In my opinion, I don't think it's a good thing for the countries of the developing world and the third world as well. Yeah. I've got you stumped, Alex.
Minimum wage, but
I think the minimum wage is a reflection of all of that. See, your argument against the minimum wage was that you've got people in Southern California who are willing to work for less than the minimum wage, and I'm saying that that's a consequence of specific government policies that say, A, they're not going to penalize people who hire people who are not citizens, and B, that they're going to allow corporations to ship jobs offshore. And really, I should flip that around, because the shipping jobs offshore is more corrosive and more destructive to decent wages in the United States than illegal immigration. So, anyhow, Alex, thanks for the call. I appreciate the conversation. It's always good to have a thought-provoking discussion. Congressman Jay Inslee hopefully will be with us here in the next segment to discuss his proposal to impeach Alberto Gonzalez. Stick around. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Well, little George might strike you as a rube, but he's the one that's grinning on the tube. He knows he owes it all to Dad, that and several hanging chads. Yeah, little George, he's smirking right at you.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Congressman Jay Inslee is with us. He represents the 1st District of Washington State. His website, house.gov/Inslee, I-N-S-L-E-E. And Congressman Inslee, welcome to the program.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. You are introducing a resolution today directed at the House Judiciary Committee. You want to share the details with us?
Yeah, we will be introducing a resolution that would require the Judiciary Committee to conduct an investigation to determine if articles of impeachment should be filed against Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. The original co-sponsors pretty much are all people like myself who have served as prosecuting attorneys, and we all know how important it is to maintain the integrity of the judicial system and believe that right now we've had a substantial degradation of people's trust because of the multiple acts of malfeasance by this attorney general.
For example?
Well, I think there are many acts, but they fall into three broad categories. First, it is indefensible for an attorney general to have allowed the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys because they would not do the political bidding of the White House. The deadliest thing to democracy is to allow the politicization of the justice system, and it's very clear that that went on. John McKay, a very well-respected guy up in Seattle, appointed by a Republican, doing a great job. He's fired after he refuses to pursue a bogus voter fraud investigation that the Republicans' operatives wanted him to pursue, and that's just indefensible. Second, there have been indefensible multiple instances where the Attorney General have allowed the violation of our rights of privacy, and I think that's become clear, and the testimony is most recently from the former director of the FBI. And third, we've had these multiple occasions that are really stunning in their boldness of consciously not being straight with U.S. Congress and by extension the American people. I've never seen a witness who has so repeatedly come to Congress and failed to tell the story truthfully. And so any of those singularly would be appropriate for this, what I consider the last resort, which is impeachment. But if the president will not do his job, we will do ours, and this is our responsibility.
Congressman Jay Inslee, what is the process here? You introduce a resolution for impeachment. You have some co-sponsors. If you want to go through the list, I don't have the list right in front of me here. And then what happens?
Well, we will introduce this today. We hopefully at one point we get to the floor, have it passed, have the Judiciary Committee conduct the investigation. It would then come back to the House for a vote on the resolution of impeachment. If there are 218 votes, it would then go to the Senate for trial, and in the Senate, the trial is conducted, and to actually remove the individual from office, it takes two-thirds of those voting to pass it. This has happened at least once in American history. One thing I should say up front, many people did not know, but the Constitution does call for the impeachment of all civil officers who violate their obligation and are involved in a high crime or misdemeanor, and that clearly includes the U.S. Attorney General. This is a case where I think impeachment is something you ought to move very cautiously. I think it ought to be used very sparingly, and I think it ought to be a matter of last resort. But with the continued corruption that has gone on of the system, of the refusal to shoot straight with the American people and the stonewalling by the administration to prevent us from getting to the truth, I think it is our only tool in our toolbox of democracy to be able to protect the integrity of the judicial system, and is a thing we have to do.
Now, four members of the U.S. Senate have asked the U.S. Solicitor General, the number four official in the Justice Department, whose, I believe, his main job really is to argue cases on behalf of the U.S. government before the Supreme Court. But they've asked him to look into or to appoint a prosecutor or an investigator for possible prosecution of Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General, for these same issues that you're raising here. Why go through the impeachment venue rather than the prosecutorial venue? You're a prosecutor, former prosecutor.
Right. Well, it doesn't so potentially two reasons. One, I'm not so much concerned about the individual fate of this person. I'm concerned about democracy and not having him being in a position to be able to cause these problems. And he could actually continue to serve at the president's pleasure, even if he was convicted of perjury. The president could just continue to keep him hired, or he could pardon him, as he did with Scooter Libby. So even a perjury conviction would not necessarily solve this problem, and impeachment is the only way to do it. A president can pardon this individual for the criminal charge of perjury. He cannot pardon him when he is impeached. The Constitution is very clear on this. It says that if there is an impeachment vote and a conviction in the Senate, the president cannot pardon that individual. They are removed from the civil office, and the country moves on. And I think that is the fullest, fairest, and really only complete relief available to democracy here, and it's the one we have to have.
And what sort of a response are you getting from your colleagues in the House of Representatives, Congressman Inslee?
Well, we just started this, and we wanted to start this with a small, select group. We started with prosecutors. We think we either have six or seven people who have served as judges or prosecutors. And we wanted to start with this group. And the reason I say that is that by our history, we are people who understand how perverse the judicial system can become if it becomes infected with partisan politics. We've seen it firsthand. When you have stood up in front of a jury, as I have, and asked people to be sent to jail, you understand how powerful that position is. And once it becomes infected with partisanship, it is very, very dangerous, and I think that's why people around the country, independents, Democrats, and Republicans, are outraged by what went on here. And I can tell you from my community, I've got as many Republicans mad about the firing John McKay as anybody else.
That's interesting. Congressman Jay Inslee, his website, house.gov/Inslee, he's representing Washington State's 1st District and representing it very, very well. Congressman Inslee, thanks so much for being with us.
Take care.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up next, in depth with activist Tom Hayden about the future of activism and the United States.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom Hayden on the line with us. He has a new book out, Ending the War in Iraq. As Tom Matzey of MoveOn.org says, this book is indispensable to anyone seeking an end to the Iraq War. Tom Hayden, welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you, Tom?
Just great. Great to have you with us.
Well, up there, are you on the houseboat today?
No, I'm broadcasting from the Clear Channel studios at KPOJ, where we normally do the show from. But
you're a landline.
Yeah, yeah. And you are where today?
I'm in my house waiting to go to my office.
Ah, okay.
Just another lovely day here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, yeah. Good, good. In your book, you're talking about... Actually, there's a number of points that I wanted to extract from your book and from our previous conversation, from the conversations that we had both on the air and off the air when we were both in Croatia last month. This whole idea of the insiders and the outsiders, you know, of the Machiavellians and the movement, and how it relates to the Iraq War. There was one point that you made in our last conversation that I really wanted to draw out a little from you, and that's the idea that the movement in the 60s and 70s that you and I were part of, I mean, you were a major, one of the founders of, and that it kind of faded with the end of the war, and you had expressed some concern that the movement that has emerged and coalesced around the Iraq, the invasion and ongoing occupation of Iraq might fade with the end of that war. Can you address that for a moment?
Well, the theory is that movements arise at the margins and they enter the mainstream. They become a majority. They tend to achieve their core original goal, but in doing so, they contend with the Machiavellian order, the power technicians, the various institutional elites. And when the reform is achieved, like ending the draft, ending the Vietnam War, the movement tends to fade, and the argument becomes one of memory, like what happened, and those memory lessons are extremely important. The same thing could happen with Iraq, although it seems to me we've got a ways to go before any Machiavellians finally give up. But it's possible that American combat troops will leave, American oil companies will enter, and American advisors will try to stay and fight a more low visibility and kind of mean and dirty war. And
They do in Nigeria, for example.
Right. There won't be any memory, any social memory that there was an anti-war movement. So that's one reason I tried to write this book, to give the reader a sense of scale of what the anti-war movement has actually done and how astounding it is that there's virtually no coverage in the mainstream media.
Yeah. And that's another point. And that comes out of the idea that the Machiavellians and the mainstream media are essentially one and the same.
They are integrated at the hip or the brain. I don't know which it is, but we're entering a new phase of the war from the Pentagon's viewpoint. This is General Petraeus's fine counterinsurgency war, and activists are going to have to learn what counterinsurgency is, but it's aimed at pacifying the home front by getting the combat casualties down this year. Mm-hmm. And it could happen. I think you and I had a difference of opinion. You were pretty sure that it was going to happen, that the combat troops were going to fade.
Yeah,
I'm not sure, but certainly from what I've seen, the army is stressed to the breaking point, and they're talking about April as the last possible date that they can sustain this escalation or surge. And so that's right in the middle of the presidential election. So we'll see.
Yeah. We'll see. Well, and in fact, an interesting piece over at it's published in Huffington Post, I believe it's published nationally by Ann Flaherty and Kimberly Heffling. And the headline is "More in the GOP Want Iraqi Military Limits." And basically what they're talking about is how large numbers of Republicans are now starting to aggressively speak out within their own party and to the levers of power or the carriers of power within the Republican Party, saying, you know, this fall is the time to begin the pullout and let's get these guys down so that let's get our military mission down to the point that by spring or summer of next year, they're at least not engaged in combat, so there are not reports of bodies coming home.
Well, that would surprise me if they got that far, but it's certainly true that the Republicans, like poor Norm Coleman out there facing former Air America.
Al Franken.
I was going to say DJ, Al Franken.
Yeah. Okay.
Maine, New Hampshire, Oregon, Virginia. There's senators in the Republican camp who are going to have to go to President Bush and Karl Rove and say, look, Bush isn't running anymore, but we are, and you want the Republican numbers in the Senate to drop by another 5 or 6? All you have to do is stay in Iraq. So there is some pressure. I don't think it's to get all the way out. I think it's, as the writers in Huffington Post appear to have said, it's to get the casualties down. So we'll see soon enough in September, but there's going to be another change. And the point is, from the history of Vietnam, you learn that every time an administration faces a showdown, their desire to preserve the reputation as a superpower wins out, and they adopt a new strategy, a new escalation, to try to squeeze a victory out of the miserable situation they've wrought. And I can't think of many cases except Mogadishu where the United States just pulled troops. I guess Lebanon and Mogadishu, right?
Yeah, as far as I know, it's...
But you've got 150,000 troops on the ground. You've got the oil resources.
Well, Vietnam, too.
Hmm?
You know, Vietnam, too, although there were the Paris Accords. I mean, that actually was somewhat organized, and South Vietnam didn't fall, as you point out in your book, for another 2 years after...
I think that might have been prearranged. Well, we don't know.
You said it was a decent interval.
Yep, there was a decent interval. Also, the parallel with today would be that the Nixon administration was wounded, ultimately fatally wounded, by the impeachment process, which could happen also to Bush. Had he stayed in office, I don't know if Nixon would have acquiesced in the collapse of the Saigon government without extending more bombing to North Vietnam or something, or sending troops back. But these are hairy days, you know, when you've got a superpower with all that reputation on the line, and it's bogged down in a quagmire. It's facing defeat. What are they going to do? What we do know is that they won't choose to get out, and therefore we have to apply, as my book tries to describe, people power against the pillars of the policy. That is, there are certain things that the war policy needs. It needs strong public support. It needs endless budgetary funding. It needs troops. It needs more and more recruits and so on, international allies. And all of those are falling, but maybe not fast enough. Petraeus wants to get the U.S. military through the election cycle and then continue the counterinsurgency war beyond that. Whether our politicians running for president and Congress have what it takes will depend on whether there's a strong enough voter bloc and pressure from the grassroots. Remains to be seen.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking with Tom Hayden, and in fact, we will be talking with Tom Hayden here for about 40 minutes or so, taking your calls at the bottom of the hour for him if you have specific concerns or questions. Tom, we've got to take a break in just a few seconds, but what I want to get into when we get back from the break is that the parallels, the ongoing parallels, the surprising parallels between the Bush administration and the Nixon administration. The Nixon administration ultimately was brought down by not by the Vietnam War, but by violating the Constitution. And that's what we're seeing right now.
I think they had to violate the Constitution because they were committed to Vietnam.
Yeah, well, or were they committed to maintaining power? But
that too, absolutely.
Yeah, we'll continue this conversation when we come back. Tom Hayden, founding member of Students for Democratic Society, author of the Port Huron Statement, one of the Chicago Eight in the 1968 Democratic Convention, elected to the California State Assembly in 82, to the State Senate 10 years later, serving 18 years in politics in California. Now the author of Ending the War in Iraq, 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
We keep on waiting.
or getting out there and making a change. On the 17th of August, by the way, today the last day of July, August beginning tomorrow, on the 17th, Friday, I will be live, doing the show live from K-Talk in Los Angeles, and that Friday night at a theater, the time and theater to be announced shortly, I'll be doing a Q&A after Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour, is opening. I'm in the movie, and should be an interesting time. On the 20th, on Monday, the following Monday, we'll be doing the same thing from New York City and broadcasting live from New York City. And on the 24th, the Friday of that week, we'll be doing it again with another local theater in San Francisco, and I'll be broadcasting live from our affiliate in San Francisco, KQKE, The Quake. So, and in New York will be WWRL, our affiliate in Manhattan. Tom Hayden is with us. He's the founding member of Students for Democratic Society, author of the Port Huron Statement, one of the Chicago Eight, a former politician, former activist, actually ongoing activist, the author of a number of books, his most recent, Ending the War in Iraq. And, Tom, we were talking about the Constitution and Nixon, and the point that I wanted to get to on this is that I don't think that most Americans recall, maybe they do, maybe I'm wrong on this, but I don't think that most Americans recall that really the charges against Nixon, that the impeachment, that when they first offered articles of impeachment against him, had to do with his violating his oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. And with the war over, that concern about the Constitution seemed to fade. And it's been a lot of years since we've heard much discussion about the Constitution outside of, you know, some, you know, just a few fringe political activists on the right and left. Yeah, legal circles. And now, again, here we are. We have an ongoing occupation or a war, a conflict, whatever you want to call it. And we have a president who is aggressively violating the Constitution. If this war ends, or if the conflict in Iraq is brought down to an acceptable level for a decent interval, do you think that the discussion of the Constitution is going to go away? Because it seems like, you know, we've already gone so far beyond the line that Congress drew in the sand with Nixon that it's almost irreparable.
Well, nothing's irreparable. I think that, you know, obviously if the war were to end or become more invisible, as you suggest, the concern about the Constitution would fade a little bit in an immediate sense. But there's a number of issues that simply won't go away that have to do with democracy versus empire, the growth of unbelievably large national security complex, the growth of secrecy, the extension of the Patriot Act, the war on terror, so-called, being the justification for these intrusions. And I think that each one of them brings a response. I mean, you've seen the president trying to chastise and attack the big law firms that do pro bono work on Guantanamo, as if they're now, our prestigious law firms are shielding terrorists. And this has set off a real reaction in powerful places that was, I don't know what the president had in mind, but there's any number of issues like that, and there'll be another Iraq soon enough if we don't do our job. So I don't think the constitutional issues will go away. I think it needs to be part of the frame that critics constantly make.
Yeah, and a wise one. You write in your book, I know, therefore, that we live on borrowed time. We can assume that somewhere in our government plans are already prepared for moving our country in a more authoritarian direction at home and an even more militaristic one abroad should there be another September 11th scale attack. And then you go on to note that most Americans aren't with that. The vast majority of us, you say, are done with the Crusades. What's your take on the probability of this? And I mean, it seems like the gun is loaded, that they have totally set this thing up, and it's just a matter of pushing over the domino, the first domino.
I don't know. I'm not paranoid in saying that. I'm merely pointing out that the Patriot Act wasn't written in 15 minutes. It's a massive document. Somebody prepared it long before 9/11, and it was ready to go in draft form. And similarly, there are plans that we know very little about that are ready to go if, and this is a huge if, there's another military attack or some kind of episode that shifts the attention of the American people to, you know, a frightened response.
Right.
I'd like to know what those are. I'm glad that Hillary Clinton asked the Pentagon whether they had any draft plans for withdrawal.
Well, and now Peter DeFazio, Congressman Peter DeFazio from Oregon, has asked the White House for their contingency plans in the event of a 9/11 attack, and they're refusing
right.
to give them to him.
Yeah, but they do have them.
Yeah, oh, yeah. But they're refusing to share them with a member of the Homeland Security Committee.
Yeah, no, obviously it's finally up to the president and the situation at the time. But, yes, they have them, and I think concentration should be focused there. And we can get very concrete about it. Who would be?
We need to be looking at what they're planning.
Up and so on.
Yeah, we need to be looking at what they're planning down the road. We're talking with Tom Hayden. TomHayden.com, by the way, his website. And we'll be taking your calls for Tom Hayden. Any specific questions right after this break. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. Head over to theairamerica.com/Tom Hartman page on the web and join our blog. Participate in the blog, and we may pick your name out, your post out, and send you a copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So over at airamerica.com, click on Tom Hartman page. We're talking with Tom Hayden, his new book, Ending the War in Iraq. And, Tom, before we just start picking up calls here, any thoughts or comments you wanted to share, you know, following on our conversation up to this point?
Sure. Let me explain the title of the book and summarize. I think the war can be ended by people power pressing against the pillars of the policy. That means if you're in a close congressional district or a close state politically, electoral politics makes a lot of sense to push the dial of public opinion in the direction of ending the war. If you're in a peace group, you need to create coalitions with groups whose funding is being undermined by the $200 million a day that's spent on Iraq so that the peace movement can broaden its links. Third, it's very important to support dissenters within the military, ground troops as well as generals, and to let the make sure that the military recruiters on our high school and community college campuses have a real debate so our kids are not dragged off for economic reasons into these life-threatening situations. That's what I mean by the pillars. You need soldiers, you need money, you need public opinion. Now, because the government is so hell-bent on saving its reputation as a superpower, I think the war will end when an internal decision is made that the pillars have fallen, that there's the cost-benefit analysis runs very heavily towards cost and no benefit. And what all they really need to do is to work with those in the Iraqi government. There's 144 members of parliament, for example, who've already signed on for a U.S. withdrawal. The Iraqi people are there, 80% of them, simultaneously, the U.S. can announce that it's finished its job, so to speak, and that it's planning to leave in 6 months or 12 months or
declare victory and go home.
Arrived at. And at the same moment, to do the best we can to avoid greater instability or chaos or bloodshed, announce an international conference involving diplomacy with Saudi Arabia, with Jordan, with Syria, with Iran, with Europe, with Russia, with China, because those countries have held back as long as the U.S. is committed to be the occupier. But when the U.S. says we're ending our occupation, all those countries have an immediate interest in helping with security, with stability, with the refugee crisis, with economic assistance and reconciliation. So that's the way I think it will be done and should be done.
Yeah. And this, in a very real way, though, isn't this what most Republicans would love to see happen? Because it would take away from the Democrats the war as an issue in the 2008 election?
Not
to say that it shouldn't happen. I mean, you know.
Yeah, the Republicans are probably divided in their between their own militarism and their desire for reelection. And there's not a lot of courage in Congress these days. You know, it's absent. But sure, a Republican like Hagel or somebody could probably make a heroic break for independence and give all the players a run for their money. I don't think it will happen. I think the war will end with politicians playing a much more modest role. I wish I was wrong, but if we lead, they will follow. That's the formula that I would recommend.
Yeah, well, it's always been that case. I mean, you know,
not always. I mean, I remember there were more heroic politicians during Vietnam. This is Ron Dellums.
Yeah, Wayne Morris, for that matter.
And he's succeeded by Barbara Lee, and she's like a vote of one.
Yeah, yeah. And we had Wayne Morris, who was, you know, one of the two
absolutely.
Members of the Senate.
Yes, absolutely. And Brunin, a number.
Interesting.
Fulbright.
Yep, but, let's expand. Go ahead.
Well, no, I'm just saying that's in the past. I mean, the point now is the anti-war movement has had any number of large demonstrations, 9 of more than 100,000, and public opinion has moved rapidly, more rapidly than during Vietnam, to view this war as a mistake. One of the new factors, you mentioned outside-inside at the beginning, and I'd just like to say a word about that. What I mean is sometimes the anti-war presence seems invisible because in our heads we believe that the anti-war movement should be outsiders in the streets, being gassed, being arrested, being dragged away. Otherwise, it doesn't exist, which is just a phenomena in our minds because the outsiders have significantly more room to move on the inside on this issue. An example, the thing that stupefied me when I was researching the book was how the anti-war forces have become political players. MoveOn members actually contributed $180 million to candidates in 2003 and 2004. It's unbelievable. The theater goers to Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 were in the many tens of millions, breaking all records for attendance at a documentary. So do we call them outsiders, insiders? I think the truth is both, and the proof is the outcome of the November 06 elections when you had neither party particularly wanting the war to be the biggest issue, and yet public opinion made it the biggest issue and resulted in an overturning of the Republican hold on Congress, which has sent a real shudder through the political system.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. We're talking with Tom Hayden. TomHayden.com, his website, his new book, Ending the War in Iraq. Let's take a couple of calls here, Tom, and broaden this conversation a little. Pete in Minnesota, you're on the air and live with Tom Hayden and me.
Yeah. Greetings, Tom and Tom. Hey, I'm just kind of an ordinary citizen. I'm ready to activate, but I need help to do this because I think, like a lot of ordinary citizens, we're looking for infrastructure to get grassroots movement to go. And the issue I feel that would help end the war, and I could use some help from you guys, is the Save the Constitution issue. And I really feel like we need to get bipartisan support. And if there's some way we could get some PSAs done by prominent Republicans like Bruce Fein and others, that we can then, like local groups that I could help create in Minnesota, could help fund getting those PSAs on local conservative talk stations and try to get, you know, wake up the conservatives that are asleep at the wheel or don't believe any of this, you know, constitutional crisis rhetoric. Is there some way that you guys can help get some kind of PSAs going that we could access all over the country locally?
Good question.
That's
Tom Hartman's going to answer that question for you, ladies and gentlemen.
that's a very good idea, Pete. Let me kick that around with a couple of people. The idea of getting Republicans to speak out and then providing that to activist groups to get into the hands of other Republicans in a whole variety of ways. That's an excellent idea. I'm going to have to defer on that for a few minutes, but or maybe a couple of days. But, Pete, thanks for the idea, and keep listening. Stick around. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Len in New York City. Hey, Len, you're on with Tom Hayden.
Hey, nice to speak with you both. It's an honor. You know, Cindy Sheehan was rolling through New York planning to run against Nancy Pelosi in the general election. And I was thinking, after hearing you, that she would probably do a lot better for the anti-war movement if she put a heat on her in the primary and ran as a Democrat. What do you think about that?
Well,
Tom, you
the problem
as a politician,
there's too much public and media focus on one person's activities. Cindy did a great job, and she dropped out, then she came back. So I'm going to wait and see how serious this congressional run is. She could be the wind at Pelosi's back. That's true. But that would be true whether she ran as an independent or as a Democrat. Pelosi certainly needs pressure, although I think it's a big mistake to say that both parties are exactly the same on Iraq.
Yeah, doesn't Pelosi need support as much as she needs pressure?
She needs, well, there's a way that pressure can be support, and certainly not by running against her, but Pelosi, first of all, needs to be clear that what's at stake here is getting the whole war over. And then we need to be aware that the number of Democrats in that caucus that really believe the whole war should be over, including getting the advisors out and all those guys, is probably about two-thirds of the Democrats and two or three Republicans. So that's the hand she's dealt with. And it's a tough question how to pressure her successfully to move those numbers.
We'll have to pick it up on the other side of the break here. We're talking with Tom Hayden. TomHayden.com is website. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Tom Hayden. TomHayden.com is website. His new book, Ending the War in Iraq. And Tom, you were making a point when we hit the break at the last break. You want to just wrap that up and we'll go to another caller?
I don't know where I was cut off. I'll take another call.
Okay, great. Let's move along here then. Vicki in Morgan Hill, California. You're on the air with Tom Hayden.
Hi. This is Vicki Madrid. I'm calling because the only way that they stopped the Vietnam War was when Congress stopped funding the war. You know, Nixon ran on the platform that he had a plan to end the war, and all he did was invade Cambodia and Laos. And then Gerald Ford, when he took over, he wasn't making any efforts to end the war. And so why aren't the Democrats talking more about, you know, the only way that we can end the war is to stop the funding, and this has been, do we have to wait until 58,000 troops are dead before we come to that conclusion?
As I recall, and I was there, but that doesn't mean my memory is perfect. The war ended simultaneous with Watergate, and then came the end of funding. Before that, there were a number of partial measures which were useful, but it really wasn't until the Congress was faced with the question to try to fund a re-escalation of the war that they gave up. So,
and that was post-impeachment.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was around the same year, a month or two later. Nixon was so weakened anyway, nobody was going to go out on a limb to save him. The caller's question, however, is why don't they do this? Well, that's fairly easy to explain. If you look at the numbers in any poll that you wish, you'll find that the number of American voters who want the immediate end of the funding of the war is not single digit, but it's less than 20%. That's the problem. And the Democrats and the Republicans will not get ahead of public opinion. Public opinion has been, I think, increasingly in favor of a one-year pullout or a six-month pullout, something that seems to address the reality that you just can't pull the plug, as they say in those circles. And the peace movement has been unable to convince people that an immediate withdrawal is what's required or an immediate end of the funding. Notwithstanding that, there were 172 members of Congress, mostly Democrats, who voted for, I think it was Barbara Lee's bill, that would wrap the end of funding around the withdrawal of the troops. So 172 is not enough to make the caller happy. It's, however, more than many people expected. And as we get into the election year, the presidential election year, I think you'll see those numbers move up. So you can either keep pushing for defunding or go back to work at the congressional district level and convince more people to sign on so that Congress gets the message. That is,
right. Or do both.
Do both. So there's just a lot of labor unions, a lot of religious groups, a lot of groups that count in the everyday life of local politics who are not being pursued enough and are not weighing in enough to get the attention of Congress for defunding.
Yeah,
until that happens, you need 218 in the House to do it. You're at 172. So it's getting close, but it's not at a breaking point yet.
Okay. Bill in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. You're live with Tom Hayden.
This is Bill from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Yep.
Both Toms, honored to be here. I would like a primer lesson, perhaps, from the two of you. Tom Hartman mentioned last week 81 communities around the country have taken a vote or have a referendum on impeachment of these oligarchs, Cheney and Bush. I would like to know if, first, if you both believe impeachment is a necessary goal to address our constitutional crisis, and if so, how can one emulate these 81 communities?
Tom?
Hartman, he said. Go ahead.
No, I brought up the issue that all these communities have called for impeachment, and I personally think that impeachment. I agree with Bruce Fein, the conservative, that impeachment is the remedy for the constitutional crisis that we're experiencing right now. I don't see impeachment as a constitutional crisis, and in fact, if you go back, I got an email here from Edward. I don't know if he wants his last name used. He points out that in 1787, in the Samuel Johnson's dictionary, the dictionary that the founders used, that the framers of the Constitution used, the word impeachment is defined as, quote, to hinder, to impede, to accuse by public authority, end of quote. It's not removal from office. That happens in the Senate. And his point is that impeachment and conviction are two quite separate things, and that impeachment is a process that has its own juice, and that given, and we only have about a minute left before we're out of this hour, Tom, what do we do? How do we move forward for impeachment? What's your opinion?
My focus is on ending the war in Iraq. I view impeachment through that lens, and to the extent that the call for impeachment weakens the White House, limits its options, puts them on the defensive, it's already having a positive effect. To the extent that people are being derailed because of their crimes and misdemeanors, Alberto Gonzalez, Scooter Libby, there's a whole Wolfowitz, there's a whole bunch of people that have been part of a kind of informal impeachment of this White House, and that's all to the good. Whether it happens sooner or later or not at all, I don't know, but certainly the effort should be sustained.
Yeah, very well said. Tom Hayden, TomHayden.com, his website, Ending the War in Iraq, his new book. Tom, thanks so much for being
with
us.
Thanks very much, Thomas. Bye-bye.
Great talking with you. Coming up next, outsourcing our defense contracts with Jeff Golomowski. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Jeff Golomowski is with us. He is a blogger, a reporter, an investigative reporter and staff writer, not a blogger, over at Cybercast News Service, cnsnews.com. The conservative news site, but Jeff, you are not a conservative?
Personally, no. I'm a journalist, so I try not to have any opinions at all as far as what I cover. But personally, when I'm not working, I would definitely consider myself a moderate to pretty far left-leaning liberal. So
one of those liberal media types, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's great, actually, that CNS News... .com has invited you to participate over there and to write, and I'm seeing that actually over, like, for example, in Huffington Post, you know, from time to time, conservative folks posting over there. One of the stories that you co-authored over at cnsnews.com is about U.S.-based Armor Holdings, and which makes the armor used in military vehicles and body armor for U.S. soldiers, and BAE Systems and what's going on with BAE Systems, and which they just have merged with, or they've agreed to merge with, and give us the overview here.
Well, BAE Systems is the largest British arms dealer there is. They're one of the largest, if not the largest, in Europe, and they're one of the top 10 largest arms manufacturers in the United States. They're also, what sets them apart is they're under investigation by the U.S. Justice Department for allegedly spending about $2 billion to bribe Saudi officials in order to get an $80 billion contract to supply the Saudi Air Force with British-made fighter jets. And among the Saudi officials linked to the investigation are Prince Bandar bin Sultan, who, of course, was one of the ambassadors to the United States from the kingdom all the way from the early 80s through just a couple of years ago. When it went over
also to, known as Bandar Bush.
Yeah, pretty much. A close friend of the Bush family and a very, very high muckety-muck in Washington power circles. What's interesting about this is over the last 10 years, BAE Systems has spent literally billions upon billions of dollars buying up U.S. arms companies and defense contractors. And they've also spent millions and millions of dollars lobbying the U.S. government and giving out tons of campaign contributions, all of it in an attempt to get more U.S. tax dollars from contracts. And they are now one of, if not the largest, foreign recipient of U.S. contracts in the world.
So what we've come to now as a consequence of globalization, I guess, for lack of a better word, is that our tax dollars are going to buy defense-related products and services to presumably defend the United States to a foreign company, and the profits are staying in that foreign company's country, presumably, by and large. And, first of all, I'm right up to that point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The money is flowing into BAE Systems corporate coffers, and there's an American version and there's a UK version, but they are the American version is a wholly owned subsidiary.
Right, and so this is really the fulfillment of Dwight Eisenhower's concern of the military-industrial complex, is it not? I mean, this is just a classic example of an industry that has. That through a whole variety of means, mainly having their hands on the levers of power through the use of lobbying and campaign funding and publicity, and I'm just waiting for them to be like so many other defense contractors do, buying, you know, very expensive 60-second spots on CNN News and MSNBC and whatnot, so that the media won't go after them. I mean, this is the military-industrial complex.
Oh, absolutely. And what makes it so fascinating isn't necessarily that they are under investigation for bribery, it's that they're under investigation to begin with. I mean, if you talk to people in the arms industry, they'll tell you that what BAE Systems is accused of doing and what they are doing as far as lobbying Congress and spending money on elected officials over here, is not something the other companies aren't doing. It's just something the other companies like Lockheed and Northrop Grumman and Boeing just aren't getting caught doing. There have been scandals involving Boeing.
Maybe they just do it much more elegantly. I mean, there's a world of difference between what was done with Duke Cunningham and what is done every day with every other member or most of the other members of Congress in terms of campaign contributions in exchange for getting legislation out. I mean, Cunningham was just stupid in the way he handled it, or corrupt or whatever beyond that. It's still the same thing. Money goes in and things happen. I mean, it may just be that the other companies are doing it in a way that is legally correct, even if the consequences are essentially the same.
Oh, absolutely. I think that I'm sure because the Saudis don't have a democratically elected government, it's bribing them. There isn't a Federal Elections Commission in Saudi Arabia that you can that's going to monitor this stuff. I mean, you're right. They don't really need to bribe American officials because they just give campaign contributions. And I spoke with a lot of campaign finance experts as we were working on these stories, and the one thing that everybody kept coming back to is, look, these companies don't spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on buying stuff for the parties themselves and on contributions to individual members of Congress if they're not getting something out of it. And what it comes down to is the big corporations are going to be able to say, hey, look, we gave you $15,000 for your convention and we gave you our maximum legal limit every year. So your staffer at least, or you personally, are going to listen to us and at least give us a fair hearing when a bill affecting our interests is going to come up. And that's something that you or I, who don't have the resources to be able to give that kind of money, just isn't going to be able to get.
Yeah, we're talking with Jeff Golomowski of CNSNews.com about this investigative report on BAE and U.S.-based armor holdings and whatnot. This is really a dimension of something much, much larger. And is there any, are you finding, as you look into stories like this, any kind of consensus at all among the political class in America, the people who are active participants in politics, elected officials in particular, that A, this is a problem, and that B, that there might be some viable solution to it of, you know, the Dwight Eisenhower's concern about a permanent military-industrial complex perverting or twisting democracy, small d democracy?
Well, I'm definitely not getting a consensus from the elected officials that there is a legitimate problem. A lot of them like to pay lip service to the idea of, oh, well, I don't want to be beholden to special interests. But the way most of them get around it is by saying, look, I make my decisions, and If they want to give me money knowing what my decisions are, I'm not going to stop them. And if they don't want to give me money, I'm not going to stop them. I'm kind of paraphrasing what Duncan Hunter said in response to one of our articles, because Duncan Hunter is actually the largest Republican recipient of money from BAE Systems and the second largest recipient of all of Congress, number one being John Murtha.
So in a way, you can go into Congress and you can say, okay, if I want to be a successful member of Congress, I know in advance that these are the positions I need to take because this will bring money from this company, or this industry, and that industry. And so you just take those positions and the money follows. So that's clearly not bribery, because in bribery, the money comes first and the position comes second. But it really is just as corrupt a system.
Oh, absolutely it corrupts the system, because it is always in the back of these guys' minds. I mean, when they go in and are voting on a program, for example, a perfect example is the F-22, the Joint Strike Fighter, which has cost, it's going to wind up costing something like $160 billion or $60 billion and $160 million per fighter jet to be able to build this thing. If they vote against continuing funding for this, you know that Lockheed Martin and BAE Systems, both groups that are building this jet, are going to be able to walk into that office and say, well, that's great, but if you decide not to vote for this, then that plant that's in your district that employs 2,000 of your constituents is going to have to close, because we aren't going to have the business anymore to be able to keep that open. And something tells us that when we tell our employees the reason it had to close is because we lost a major federal contract, they're not going to like their representative in Congress very much the next time around. And these representatives who are up every 2 years, what are they going to be able to do to say to that? Because they know that doing that, especially on the House side, is as good as the kiss of death. And so they kind of find themselves over a barrel very, very quickly.
So if you want to make a fortune these days, just become a defense contractor.
Oh,
it's,
absolutely.
It's almost bulletproof.
Absolutely.
You know, no pun intended. Interesting. Jeff Golomowski, CNSNews.com, the website. Jeff, the lone liberal over there. Jeff, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour in the Tom Hartman program. What's up with Bill O'Reilly? Well, it looks like Home Depot has now pulled their ads from his website. Very interesting. A little more right after this. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Over at AmericaBlog.com, they are reporting, and I don't have any separate confirmation of this, so we'll see, but they're reporting that Home Depot has said in emails to listeners of, or actually viewers of Bill O'Reilly's website, that thanks for your email. We will not and have not advertise, this is one, have not advertised in the Bill O'Reilly Show. Here's another email from somebody at Home Depot, or is presented as such, that says, thank you very, very much for your message. The Home Depot has a policy that prohibits the running of its advertising on programs that express strong opinions or political views. Please note that this includes Bill O'Reilly's program, and so on. So that's interesting. First it was Lowe's, now it's Home Depot, apparently. And in this context, and you know, let's keep in mind Mr. O'Reilly's friendly words about us and this network.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Mike Stark is with us. His website, callingallwingnuts.com. And Mike, Bill O'Reilly had, first of all, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks very much, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Bill O'Reilly sent a film crew over to the apartment, the private residence of the president or the CEO of JetBlue Airlines, to ask him questions about JetBlue's support of or in advertising sponsorship of the Daily Kos convention, which caused JetBlue to pull their ads, and has also apparently suggested to his listeners that they should show up at your home. Do I have that right, that you said that? Or that he's
yeah, that's exactly correct. If you go to Daily Kos right now, I think I've got the top diary. I'm not sure because I've been on the road for 2 hours. But essentially it chronicles my visit to Bill's home this morning. And in that diary, I've put a link up to the page at Calling All Wingnuts, in which he threatened to come to my house and surprise me. Paul Krugman actually wrote about that one. This was probably about 18, 19 months ago now. But, yes, that's exactly what he said. He said, I had referenced Media Matters on the air and what a great website they were. And he said, oh, geez, I got another nut. You know, we should all go to his house. We should go to his house and surprise him. So he was doing that as recently as last Friday, too. He had said that he should take all the Thatcher listeners led by him and Edie Hill or him and, his other co-hosts and show up at another CEO's home to surprise him. And you know, I thought I'd surprise him at his home this morning. And I think I was pretty successful at that. I think I was really successful at distributing the Andrea Macris court filings to all of his neighbors. What I did was I showed up at the end of his driveway with a bunch of signs, you know, signs that said pervert and Andrea Macris has your cash and cheater and liar and Bill O'Reilly can't be trusted around your daughters and things like that. And I put these large signs up throughout his neighborhood, distributed the Andrea Macris filings to each one of his neighbors so everyone in his neighborhood knows exactly why those signs are in their neighborhood. I saw him at the foot of his driveway, told him this was his accountability moment, asked him to walk through the neighborhood with me so I could show him the work that we had done. He began walking down to the end of the driveway with me. He said, you know you're on my property, right? I said, sure, and I'll leave the minute you ask me to. He continued walking with me to the end of the driveway, bent over, picked up his newspaper, and walked back into his house. I was able to shout a few more questions at him, but I didn't pursue him. I mean,
well,
Mike,
let me tell you where this is, I think, qualitatively different from what O'Reilly did, because what O'Reilly did was not engage in personal attacks against the CEO of JetBlue, just asked him if his company supported a particular position. I'm not sure why would you go after him as a person and talk about, you know, his private life stuff or his business stuff for that matter, Andrea Macris, rather than raise the issues of some of the positions that he's taken on his programs?
Because that was the most effective way at demonstrating to the entire world what a morally bankrupt person that this person is. If you haven't read the Andrea Macris filings, I think you have to read those.
I have, but I still think that at a certain point we might do ourselves well by separating the person from the positions.
I think that works when this person isn't trying to destroy you. And he has said repeatedly that he is out to destroy us. And the quickest way to attack that man's credibility is to show everyone in the world exactly how low he will go. To threaten Andrea Macris that he will drag her name through the mud, that he will make her wish she had never been born, that any woman that he's had affairs with, that's what he would do if they ever went public. That's the most despicable thing I've ever heard in my life. This multi-million dollar media commodity using all of his power to crush this young producer definitely shows the type of man that this is in terms of everything else that he does. And it is absolutely the quickest way to cut to the chase and let people know.
Yeah, very interesting. Mike Stark, callingallwingnuts.com, his website, taking on Bill O'Reilly today. And you're going to be previewing the video of this over at the Kos convention, right?
I hope I will get that opportunity. That hasn't been negotiated or arranged yet.
Okay, and you can also read it at dailykos.com. Mike, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Take care.
27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And the sign said, everybody welcome, come in, kneel down and pray. So they passed around a plate at the end of it all, but I didn't have a pen and a pen. So I got me a pencil and a paper, and I wrote my own little sign. It says, thank you, Lord, for thinking of me. I'm alive and doing fine. Yeah, signs, signs everywhere, signs. Blocking out the scenery, breaking my mind. Do this, don't do that. Can you read the signs?
I can read the signs of the time. I'll tell you, the signs of the time, even the Republicans are talking about it. It's the signs of the time. There's change coming. Over at thehill.com. In fact, JSF talking about it in our live chat room, which you can get to by going over to airamerica.com or tomhartman.com and just link on the live chat link and drop in and hang out with some of the finest minds on the entire Internet. Points to an article on The Hill. Anxious Republicans fear another beating. Yeah, well. It could be. It may well be. And in the news of the strange today, at the urging of top conservative bloggers, this, by the way, from rawstory.com, the White House set up a conference call to promote its message on the subject of executive privilege. Yes, they are hosting bloggers. Right-wing bloggers only need apply, by the way. But while most of the questions relayed by Morrissey, the guy who was running the conference call, were informational, one appeared to challenge the terms of the White House's privilege assertion, et cetera. Anyway, it's interesting. Interesting, yes. It's strange, actually. I would say downright strange. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. George in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, George, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I've been listening to your show since a couple of days ago. I'm new to the program. And I have you on the website. And my question to you has to do with all that you've been talking about, corporate abuse and corporate power and the corporate personhood issue. And if it is correct that the court reporters in 1886 started all this, has this become a true law because it's been applied so many times? And
Yeah, it has. Yes. The bottom line is that it wasn't exclusively the 1886 Santa Clara County case that brought this about. That was sort of the high watermark. And the scholars over at POCLAD, the Program on Corporations Law and Democracy, POCLAD.org, and Tom over at CELDEF.org, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF.org, and, well, there's a bunch of other groups as well, have some very good in-depth information on this. I wrote a book about it called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights that was published about 4 years ago, and I would say it's still quite current. And in 1886, the court, in a tax case that involved the Santa Clara Railroad and or Santa Clara County and the Southern Pacific Railroad, ruled that the railroad was trying to say that their taxes should be the same in every county on the rights of way, on the fence posts along the rights of way, basically the property taxes that they were paying, and that to have it different from county to county. Actually, their main argument was that they didn't have to pay taxes on this because the California state constitution said so. They were paying, you know, state taxes. They shouldn't have to pay federal taxes. But one of the six arguments that they made was that as a person, they were being denied their 14th Amendment rights to not be discriminated against because they were being treated differently in one county than another. And that would be like saying that, you know, a person of color can eat in a lunch counter in one county but not in another. That was their assertion. And it was rejected, actually, by the court. The court never ruled on the constitutional matter. Over on my website, I've got an actual letter from the clerk of the court, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, to the Chief Justice of the court, Morrison Remick Waite, in his own hand, saying, you know, did you guys rule on this corporate personhood issue? And Waite writing back saying, no, we never, you know, elevated our discussion to the constitutional level because they found the solution in the California Constitution. But Morrison Remick Waite, the Chief Justice of the court, was dead within a year and a half. He died of heart failure, what looks like congestive heart failure. And the clerk of the court, who was the former president of the Newburgh and New York Railroad and was part of a conspiracy that also included Stephen J. Field, who was on a member of the Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit Court justice. At that time, the guys in the Supreme Court, 9 months out of the year, they rode the circuit. They were circuit judges, and then 3 months out of the year, they were Supreme Court judges in Washington, D.C. Stephen Field was being promoted by the railroads as a possible future presidential candidate. And they were basically saying, if you'll give us this ruling, we'll bankroll your presidential ambitions. And so he and a couple of other members of the court who were former railroad lawyers and Davis, who was the, as I said, the railroad president and also the son of the former governor of Massachusetts, a very wealthy, very well-connected guy, wrote this head note that is only a commentary. It has no legal standing, that said that corporations are persons and entitled to equal protection under the 14th Amendment. And that in and of itself didn't have legal standing, but there have been more than 30 times, almost 40 times now, that the Supreme Court has quoted that head note since then. And that established legal precedent when the Supreme Court did that. I mean, if the Supreme Court quotes Daffy Duck, it still establishes legal precedent. It doesn't matter who they quote. So even though they were quoting something that was wrong.
Recently, or is this something that peaked recently? I mean,
well, I think.
Or something that has peaked recently, like in the past.
There have been two peaks of public consciousness about this. One was in the late 1880s and then the 1890s. And the other is right now. And basically from 1900 until now, or until maybe the last 10 years, it had been pretty much ignored. But the two guys who wrote the 14th Amendment, two of the guys, a Republican, I don't have their names in front of me, it's in my book. There was a Republican who was on the Senate committee and a Republican who was on the House committee, actually made a living after that decision came down, traveling around the country, giving speeches to business groups about how they wrote the 14th Amendment to say persons rather than natural persons. Persons being a phrase that would include artificial persons, which is corporations, whereas natural persons would just refer to human beings, that they, in the 14th Amendment, only said persons intentionally to include corporations. In fact, if you go back and read the records of the deliberations, that was never the case. But there was a lot of pushback to this in the 1890s and a lot of public discussion of it. And then it kind of faded out during and after the Spanish-American War. And now it's coming back again. Did that answer your question?
That challenged any instance in the court.
One of the groups that's most effectively challenging corporate personhood is the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, and celdf.org is their website. Tom Lindsay is the head of that and an attorney, and he's spoken at the Bioneers Conference a couple of years in a row, and he's doing democracy schools all around the country. They're just doing some marvelous work, and they've gotten more than 100 communities in the state of Pennsylvania now to actually pass laws in their community saying, in our community, a corporation does not have the legal rights of a person. And that's in defiance of federal precedent.
There may be a chance that this will propagate and that we get corporations off of politics. It would be nice.
What they have done is they have claimed the First Amendment right to lie, because you and I have the right to lie as long as we don't lie to a grand jury or a police officer. And they've claimed the Fourth Amendment right to privacy, so they were able to cover up asbestos and the dangers of tobacco. Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. 14th Amendment rights against discrimination, so that, you know, a Walmart can say to a community, you can't stop us, that would be discriminating against us, and you can't do that. And these rights are just, in the opinion of many of us, and which is why I wrote the book, inappropriately being used and being done so to the destruction of democracy. George, I got to move along. Thank you for raising the topic. It's one of my absolute favorites. Ty in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Ty, listening on KPOJ. What's up?
Hey, thanks for taking me. I appreciate it. I listen to your show all the time. Actually, you know, I was discussing with my son the other day. He was wondering about his schools and why it's all messed up and how come it's so expensive just to play school sports and why we got to do all kinds of different things to make it work. So we got around to the war, and he kind of put it to me very simply, and I've been thinking about it for a few days. But, you know, after talking about it in fairly simple terms, because he's 9 years old, He kind of broke it down to me and said, "Dad, you know, we need to pull out now today." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, because two wrongs don't make a right." And I said, "What do you mean?" You know, I said, "It's a pretty complicated issue." And he said, "Well, if it was wrong to go there, then why would it be right to stay there? It's wrong to stay there, so it must be right to come home. If kids are dying every day, then we need to come home." And
that's
I believe,
brilliant.
You know, after thinking about it for a while, William Penn said something that I believe is 100% true, and that is, you know, wrong is wrong even if everybody's for it, and right is right even if everybody's against it. And,
yeah.
and we got to do what's right for the kids, both ours and theirs.
And the Iraqis. Well said, Ty. Thank you very much for sharing that. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Charlie, got about a half a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Yeah, just the consummate corruption that it took the Republicans about 20 years to do, but they've succeeded now in supplying with the Saudi arms deal both sides of an armed conflict, a maximal state of war profiteering.
Yeah, I am very concerned about this. It seems to me this deal where, not just the Saudis, I mean, they're selling weapons to a number of Middle Eastern countries, and then they're giving away weapons to Israel and to Egypt. And the whole thing seems to me like the Economic Reinvigoration for the United States Act by giving billions of taxpayer dollars to defense contractors law. And I'm totally opposed to it. Charlie, thanks for bringing it up. I appreciate it. It's a good one. Coming up next, Talk Radio News. TalkRadioNews.com and get an update on what's going on in Washington, D.C. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes before the hour. Yes, democracy is coming. Ellen Ratner with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, their website. Ellen, hang on just a second. One thing I have to mention here, if I may. Congratulations to J.W. Wisnant 97, I guess would be the complete... screen name for the blog of the day over at airamerica.com, writing, "I still find it endlessly entertaining to listen to people who still worship at the altar of supply-side Ayn Rand, Thomas Friedman nonsense, etc." And thank you very much. We will be sending you an autographed copy of Screw, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Now, Ellen Ratner. Ellen, the White House has missed the noon deadline for Gonzalez's testimony, and they're kind of sticking their thumb in the eye of Congress by saying, "We'll give it to you by the end of the day, but we ain't going to meet your noon deadline."
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was at a breakfast, sort of a liberal blogger talk radio breakfast with Nancy Pelosi this morning, and then I went to the pen and pencil that Hoyer had, and neither of them are too excited about any impeachment procedures, and they're certainly not going to do anything before the recess. And it's interesting, Nancy Pelosi said that tonight she is meeting with the president, she said that she had asked for the meeting he had not really been terribly forthcoming, but now I guess after some pressing, the president is finally going to meet with the Speaker of the House. So I don't know whether that's going to be on the topic matter. She wouldn't go into it, but I do know they're not happy about it, but she said that they are going to press ahead with their agenda no matter what.
Wow.
And then she's going to kind of leave it to flow through Judiciary Committee, et cetera.
Right.
And
right.
Hoyer pretty much said the same thing.
We had Congressman Jay Inslee on this morning. He has introduced today
this afternoon, right.
a resolution of impeachment against, or at least actually a request that the Judiciary Committee investigate the possibility of a resolution of impeachment against Gonzalez. Any sense of where that's going?
Well, again, neither Poirier or Pelosi would commit to any of that except to say, you know, this is the Democratic Party and anybody can release anything, but we have an agenda and anybody can put forth any bill. But she said, we're going to stay focused and we really are going to focus on our issues. That's the most important thing. People elected us to do that. And so that's what she just went straight ahead, and so did Steny Hoyer. They're pretty much both on the same page. She did say some interesting things other than the fact that it took her a while to get a meeting with the president. She said that she essentially called the Medicare Advantage, which, as you know, is the drug part of the Medicare issue, she called it a rip. And she said that Hospital Corporation of America has increased its value 7 times since the Medicare drug bill went through. And she felt it was designed to destroy Medicare.
Yes, absolutely. It was a poison pill. And it has made a fortune also for United Healthcare, the company that AARP, you know, sells their insurance policy through, the company that paid its CEO $1.7 billion in compensation. Yeah, you know, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Also, on this S-CHIP bill, as you know, it's going to, in terms of passing the House, it then has to go to the Senate.
There's S-CHIP being the Children's Health Insurance Program.
Right. So today, Steny Hoyer put up a quote from President Bush when he was at his 2004 convention speech saying that we're going to lead an aggressive effort to enroll millions of poor children who are eligible but have not signed up for government health insurance programs. Now he's saying he's going to veto the S-CHIP bill.
Wow. That really is a remarkable flip-flop. Although nobody will call it that, I guarantee you, in the mainstream media.
No, they won't, but we will. Also, as you know, they're trying to pass that energy bill at the end of the week. CAFE standards will not be part of that bill, and I think it's really Congressman Dingell that is holding that up. They are going to maybe do it as a separate bill at some point. Also, as Steny Hoyer said this morning, that they are going to think about getting communication companies protected from liability on privacy issues in the future, but not necessarily in the past. He also said in terms of the FISA, they are working with Republicans. They want to, quote-unquote, protect the American people.
Yeah. Now, getting back to the energy bill, and that's an interesting point, too, but getting back to the energy bill, there's also, it turns out, a one-sentence line in the energy bill that will grant, depending on whose math you're looking at, somewhere between a $10 and a $50 billion gift to anybody who wants to build a nuclear power plant to the nuclear power industry?
Yeah, I haven't seen the exact language of that. And that may actually, well, as you know, there was an application for a third reactor down at Calvert Cliffs. It's the first time I think there's been an application in 30 years. Now, I actually lived about 10 miles from Calvert Cliffs and actually keep a boat about 10 miles from Calvert Cliffs as we speak. And there's all kinds of evacuation plans if the place goes. So now they're thinking of building a third reactor down there. First application in 30 years.
Well, this is an industry that flat out would not exist without public subsidies. I mean, Price Anderson, we have to insure them because no one else will.
That's right.
I really think that we should be asking ourselves, should we be subsidizing an industry that in the free market could not exist? Anyhow, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you today. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, Robert Kohler is here. Should we, the people, be looking at something other than prison for our most heinous criminals? I'll be kicking off an hour about the Fairness Doctrine and balance in the media with guests Mark Lloyd and Roger Aronoff of AIM.org and Mark Lloyd of American Progress and Everything You Know Is Wrong, Colin Woodward, and Larry Johnson will be here. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.